As you go to your state's motor vehicle agency and wait in the long line, maybe slightly comforting to know that Alexander Hamilton didn't want things to work out this way for you. I can't say he predicted the line, but he didn't want your state to run such an agency. The wave of patriotism that spread across America after 9/11 was an example of a national mood seen only a few times in the span of American history. At the inception of the national government, even there mitigated by squabbles. The period after the War of 1812, during the Civil War, at least in the North, the short Spanish-American War period, World War I, World War II, at least in the early part of Franklin Roosevelt's term, during the Cold War, during parts of the Cold War, just like Franklin Roosevelt could pass sweeping legislation and pass it through a 1933 New Deal Congress, just as Lincoln could get his way on his emergency bills passed in the early part of his presidency, or James Monroe could create a standing army, something abhorrent in early America. And Wilson could, as Truman could, institute wage and price controls unheard of in other American eras. George W. Bush in 2001 and 2002 experienced a unprecedented grasp on national power. Homeland Security, though an amalgamation of many existing departments, represented a sweeping change in the federal government. And the Patriot Act passed both houses. Democrats and Republicans voted for it as the nation prepared for showdown with Iraq. Yet one thing that never happened that might have seemed logical after a terrorist attack that was instituted by individuals carrying fake state IDs. One thing that never happened was a national ID card. Despite a drumbeat for it, despite the orange and yellow alerts, despite the statements of many Homeland Security officials that it was coming, despite troops being sent all around the world, the national emergency, still have no national ID card. This is a testament to the power of federalism, still present today, though it's an idea as old as the nation itself. We are 50 states, the District of Columbia, Commonwealth, and many territories. The states have their own governments, their own governors, and their own legislative branches. The District of Columbia has its own local city rule. The federal government is more powerful at first glance, as the taxing authority, the IRS, the Army, federal courts, and a staggering group of bases and embassies all around the world. But many other decisions that affect us the most, education, roads, welfare, are decided by the states, even where Uncle Sam pays the bill. Alexander Hamilton didn't want it that way. He wanted a national government. This is not how it works. States in America are sovereign. They share power with the federal government. Not all power is ceded. Ultimately, federal government prevails, but it's limited by the 10th Amendment. Of course, even that limitation needs to be discussed. Nationalists got most of what they wanted. In the debate over the scope of the federal government, the federal government prints money, raises army. It gives itself, as opponents of the Constitution at the time argued, the best type of tax, at least from a government's point of view, the excise tax, a tax on imports. It's a tax that grows with as commerce grows. And it forces state governments to go after less popular taxes, property taxes, income taxes, etc. Federal law is supreme. Federal courts are separate from state courts. You'll often hear people argue that the founders wanted as small a government as possible, and it is true that many of them did, that statements or philosophies also at odds with the type of government they created. The word federal could be considered a bit of a misnomer, and certainly at the time, opponents of the Constitution picked up on this. Federal, we now associate that word with the word national. The federal government is the U.S. government, the government in Washington, the government whose laws supersede the states. But a true federal government would be something more like the government under the Articles of Confederation. It is a government funded by a group of entities, pooled together resources. Now we associate federal with national. The meaning of the word, as it should be understood to understand the system that we really have, is on our coins. From many, one. E Pluribus Unum. It is a new thing. The federal government is an entity to itself. It does not get all of its power, and it is not sponsored merely by the states. It's a tricky philosophical concept, but one that caused some violence, at least one war, and many, many arguments. As a poem in the South Carolina Gazette read, in regards to the new Constitution, "In 5 short years of freedom, we've grown. We've quit our plain republics for a throne. Congress and a president full proof shall bring, a mere disguise for a king." And it goes on. "When 13 states are molded into one, your rights are vanished and honors gone." Not a happy camper. Civis, who was probably David Ramsey of South Carolina, writing anonymously, as most did, writing under a code name, as most did, felt differently. He compared the new constitutional government to families. "When 13 persons constitute a family, each should forego anything that is injurious to the other 12. When several families constitute a parish or country, each may adapt regulations it pleases in regards to its domestic affairs, but it must be abridged of that liberty in other cases where the good of the whole is concerned." Civis was more of a nationalist. The idea of federalism, as the prevailing founders understood it, is probably best summed up in the song of Stephen Hopkinson, that pop singer, songwriter, and signer of the Declaration of Independence, in his song "For Federal Mechanics." The song designed to show the popular support that the Constitution had. "Come muster your lads, your mechanical tools, your saws and axes, hammers and rules. Bring your mallets and planes level in line, and plenty of pins of American pine. For our roof we will raise, and as any still shall be, a government firm and our citizens free." And later is the line that reveals Hopkinson's philosophy. "Up, up with the rafters, each frame is a state. How nobly they rise, their span is how great. From the north to the south, o'er the whole they extend, and rest on the walls while the walls they defend." Comparing the new government to a house with rafters and beams supporting a roof and walls. The states are individual just like frames, and they both support and get support from the wall. This was the musically rendered Federalist position. You gain something greater by the Union. You created something new. James Madison, writing in Federalist Paper 39, says, "In foundation, the government is federal. Operation of power is national, but limits to the power are federal. Sources of power are both." Anti-federalists, as they were labeled mostly by the supporters of the Constitution, wasn't a name that they embraced, were more interested in raw power than mechanics of government. We may be amused, if we please, by a treatise of political anatomy Patrick Henry wrote, but what signifies to all common purposes of legislation, it's a great consolidation of government. Patrick Henry was right in a way. Federal is the wrong word. Quasi-federal or multi-jurisdictional is a better word for the government that they created and the government we have today in America. It goes back further to the Constitutional Convention. There was already a disagreement over federalism. Now, Luther Martin, who opposed the final product of the convention and didn't sign it, raised several points of opposition along the way. He said states like his own state of Maryland came first. Separation from Britain placed Martin's Maryland and the other 12 states in a state of nature towards each other. Then, Luther Martin made clear, only then did these separate sovereignties, after declaring independence, form a federal government. James Wilson, who was more of a nationalist at the Constitutional Convention, didn't want to let Martin's point go unchallenged. "No," Wilson said, "colonies became states only when they together jointly declared independence. So they were only independent unitedly." Wilson's is the logical way, But it is true that the state of Virginia declared independence before the nation. They declared independence and then sent representatives up to Philadelphia to get everyone else to do it as well. Mostly, it's an irresolvable question and required political struggles, and at least one war to settle. In some cases, the Constitution empowered states. For instance, the non-proportional nature of the Senate is designed to protect states, whether states giant like New York or small like Delaware, they get two senators. But a less thought about aspect of the U.S. Senate they created helps the national government. Senators vote individually, not as states. We've taken that for granted now, but it was something that was talked about by the members of the Constitutional Convention when they debated it. They thought there might just be one vote per state. If you had senators who were tied, their vote didn't count. That's how the vote worked in the Constitutional Convention and in the Continental Congress that met and signed the Declaration of Independence. Each state got a vote, and if their delegation was tied, their vote wasn't counted. That's not how it works. Senators vote individually. You can have one Democrat and one Republican. You're going to have one vote for the Democratic policy and one vote for the Republican policy. Yeah, most of the time, anyway. And senators are paid not by the state, this was also discussed, but by the federal government. It gives them a little bit of allegiance to the people that are paying their salary. Initially, though, senators were chosen by the states. And that was giving the states a little bit more power in the system. Federal law is supreme, but it is supposed to be limited. That's the federal system. When Thomas Gibbons decided to operate his steamboat on the Hudson River, his license was from the federal government, but there was a problem. Aaron Ogden also operated a steamboat line on the Hudson River, and his license came from the state of New York. Ogden got an injunction, and Gibbons sued in federal court. It was a battle of article versus amendment. The Article 1, Section 8, said Congress regulated interstate commerce, but the 10th Amendment said states reserved rights, and Ogden's ships were granted powers from that reserve of rights in the 10th Amendment, the right to be the only one in interstate waters. Justice John Marshall wrote the decision that Congress has the power to regulate navigation within every state where, in conflict, federal law would prevail. In the late 19th and early 20th century, coal was the key fuel, and presidents worried about it the way that they now worry about oil. William McKinley and Theodore Roosevelt were plagued by potential strikes in coal mining country. As the Depression hit, Franklin Roosevelt sought to stabilize coal by having the federal government control wages, hours, working conditions, and enforce collective bargaining. James Walter Carter, owner of Carter Coal, didn't like that. On one side, Carter said the federal government was going too far. On the other, the Fed said wages affected price, and thus wages matter. Wages were part of interstate commerce. In a conservative era of the Supreme Court, they ruled that the Necessary and Proper Clause in the Constitution. The court ruled that the Necessary and Proper Clause in the Constitution meant that federal power was limited. In the case of the steamboat operators, it was necessary to have New Jersey and New York on either side of the Hudson River. How could one state grant interstate licenses? The federal government had to step in. But in a case like this, where you're talking about a product from a state that just happens to be sold elsewhere, federal government coming in and saying they could regulate wages, that wouldn't do. Another blow would be dealt to Roosevelt's plans. In New York City, the Schechter brothers ran a poultry company. Chickens would arrive from all around the United States, and the Schechter brothers and their workers would slaughter them and distribute them around the city. They also violated slaughter procedures and working hour regulations in the Live Poultry Code of the National Recovery Act that the New Deal Congress had passed. When federal officials tried to enforce the rules, the Schechter brothers sued. Unanimously, the Supreme Court ruled that the National Recovery Act laws went too far. What was really surprising was Franklin Roosevelt's recent liberal appointments. Benjamin Cardozo ruled with the majority. Everyone ruled against Roosevelt. It was a blow to him. In Cardozo's case, he felt they went too far and developed rules that could protect large industries over small operators. Congress continued to pass and enforce new law. 2 years later, under the threat of packing the court, the Chief Justice, Charles Evan Hughes, former contender for the presidency in 1916, who was appointed as Chief Justice in 1930, and Justice Owen Roberts, allowed the government to regulate steel. Steel was more important than, say, chickens, Hughes argued, and the products went in, were transformed, and then sent back out to various states. In effect, though, the federal government's use of regulation was affirmed. It would be 30 years later when the Heart of Atlanta Motel refused to allow black citizens to stay there that, again, the concept of federalism would be challenged. This was now illegal under the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The owner argued that his hotel did not affect interstate commerce, and nothing he did violated Georgia's laws. Why should the government, federal government, be stepping in and making his hotel do something he didn't want to do? Justice Tom Clark argued the Heart of Atlanta Motel's assertion was not true. Anything that affects, even in a minor way, someone's travel across affected interstate commerce. You are a black citizen and you can't stay at a hotel, you're not able fully to travel. That's affecting interstate commerce. Of course, this was 1964, and the extension of federal power was greater than anything in a long time. Yet when the federal government tried to regulate state workers, that was too far for the Burger Court. The federal government could not impose hour and working conditions on state workers. States' actual operations were their business. The legal history of federalism leans towards the federal government side, but doesn't totally break down the wall of federalism. When John Adams was president and the Federalists, his party, passed the Alien Deportation and Sedition Acts, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison decide they would go to the states for their opposition. With Jefferson as vice president and Madison in control of the opposition faction in the House, they got the Virginia and Kentucky legislators to nullify, in effect, the hated Alien Sedition Act, one that impressed Republican newspaper editors and sent home anyone, particularly French citizens, who opposed the federal government. They got the Virginia and Kentucky legislature to nullify these acts. The Virginia and Kentucky resolutions didn't spread to other states. They were attempted in other places, but were blocked by Federalists there. Eventually, the Alien and Sedition Law expired, and Jefferson changed policy upon taking the presidency and pardoned many of the jailed editors. The tactic used in an attempt of state legislatures to nullify federal laws was not successfully used again. But during the presidency of Andrew Jackson, the state of South Carolina decided they would try. They would nullify a tariff. No small matter, when this was the way the federal government paid for itself. Jackson, although a Southerner, dealt swiftly with the nullifiers in South Carolina, protected the federal armories, and prepared to send in troops to collect the tax if need be. South Carolina backed down. The Civil War obviously decided the question of federalism. South Carolina and other Confederates used the argument that Luther Martin had used so long ago, that the states had come first. They entered the Union, and they could leave the Union when they wanted. And over the issue of Abraham Lincoln's election, they wanted to leave the Union. Abraham Lincoln was able to force these states back into the Union. And the tools he used, the precedent, was set to some degree by Andrew Jackson's action. Lincoln was compared to Andrew Jackson by contemporaries, newspaper reporters, politicians at the time. What federalism means in America to an extent. But there are two things that have actually pushed federalism more towards the side of federal power, national government power, than even all of these questions: a constitutional amendment and a court decision. Prior to the 17th Amendment, senators were elected by state legislatures. When Abraham Lincoln battled Stephen Douglas in his famous debates, the debates were show. The only one that mattered was the debate and vote in the Illinois legislature. Although Lincoln had a slight edge in a nominal popular vote that was held, the Democratic legislature voted to bring back Douglas. For making the fight, Lincoln would become famous nationally. Throughout the 19th century, the concern was that fat cat millionaires would go to the Senate by buying up the votes of state legislators, funding the legislators' races. The passage of the 17th Amendment was one of the banner items of the progressive era, which was to reform government, make it more answerable to the people, and not big corporations and trusts, and not political bosses. Senators were now elected by the people after the turn of the century, not the state legislatures. Well, it has accomplished that, of course. State legislatures do not elect senators, but with one side effect. There's less interest in state legislatures now and state legislative races. Most people don't know their state representatives unless they're really seriously involved in politics. A second and more modern victory for a nationalist interpretation of federalism was the decision in the 80s of South Dakota versus Dole. The Congress passed a bill that would provide millions of dollars of funds for highways states wanted. States would administer those funds, with one caveat. They had to change the drinking age in their states to 21, from 18 to 21. South Dakota disagreed. South Dakota, along with some other states who felt the same way, wanted the money, but didn't want the federal government to attach requirements to it. The Supreme Court in South Dakota v. Dole ruled that it was okay for the federal government to do things this way. So the Congress can send money to states and say, well, if you take this money, you have to agree to do X. Just like the 17th Amendment, this was a major change in relations between states and the federal government, in my opinion, because most states have balanced budget requirements and they can't spend money they don't have. They depend on funds from the federal government to do things they need to do. If the federal government can attach requirements to funds that states absolutely need, then the federal government, in effect, has absolute control over many aspects of the state government. States' rights has always been a conservative issue, but recently there's been at least two issues where liberals can find themselves on the same side of the debate. One is the issue of medical marijuana, and the other is gay marriage. The federal government, liberals and libertarians, feel should not use its power to suppress California's right to declare marijuana of medical use. The federal government, many liberals feel, should not use its power to crush Vermont's right to issue marriage certificates for gays and to have those certificates accepted all around the nation. This question of federalism, state power versus federal power, could be said to be a uniquely American problem, right? Not every nation has these strong states, but really it's not. Most countries deal with this, and considering the size of America, perhaps ability for states to have some power over themselves is what's kept us together all along. Most large countries actually handle things in the same way as we do to keep things going. In Canada, giving some power to the small Quebec French-speaking population means Canadians' politicians 2,000 miles away must be bilingual when they speak in Parliament. And this is fun if you ever watch the Canadian Parliament on C-SPAN. Debate rotates from English to French during discussions. In the United Kingdom, the Scottish government has control over many of its domestic affairs, but Scottish representatives participate in the national government. There's been talk of doing the same for Wales, and there's even been discussion now as to whether they need an English government. Switzerland is an example of a country that has a closer government to what the Articles of Confederation before the Constitution dictated for the United States. Switzerland has powerful states, or cantons as they call them, and a small federal government. That the Federalists of old may have won the long-pitched battle over state or federal sovereignty is in a way evident in the healthcare debate. State solutions have been of little value in the debate, though they have been proposed. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid proposed a public health care option with a state opt-out. The state could decide to opt out of the system. The idea seemed, on the surface, to solve a key problem, after all. Healthcare polls higher in Rhode Island and Vermont than it does in South Carolina. It's logical, then, to have a government option only if you can opt out of it, or if your state can opt out of it. But although the idea has been included in the bill, it hasn't attracted a lot of popular support. It may have helped a few moderate senators vote for legislation, but it hasn't ignited the public discussion. The idea seemed to go flat. Proponents of healthcare wonder about individuals without healthcare who would be trapped in a state that decided to opt out of the system. And opponents of a government-run healthcare system want to kill the program outright and not just leave it up to a state government to decide to do it. And many opponents of the healthcare proposal wonder that even if their state opts out, will they still end up paying for the other states who do not opt out? And if one is a conservative who doesn't support a government healthcare system, even the limited one offered by the public option, and they happen to live in a state where healthcare polls high, they may be trapped as well in a system they don't want to be part of. States have lost their influence in discussion, that we've lost a bit of our connection to our state. We're still New Yorkers, Californians, and Virginians, but when it comes to policy, we'll take it federal. Dead on arrival has been any idea of keeping healthcare state-run. States run out of money. They must, in most cases, balance their budgets. This is a debate that both sides want on the open field of federal policy. Proponents of healthcare want it there so that it can be implemented nationally. Opponents want it there so it can be killed nationally. Nobody's really seriously discussing state-by-state solutions. At least in this debate, the healthcare debate, the solution that led to the construction of our Constitution has been of little use. It's an interesting development for federalism's future. I want to thank you for listening. The website is myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. I want to remind you about the archive. It's $9.99. It is available. It has almost everything that we've podcasted since 2006. You're going to hear about presidential protection, the Secret Service. You're going to read about, you're going to hear about France and America, Britain and America, guns and their role in American politics, Brown versus the Board of Education, presidential sons and daughters, the Constitutional Convention and what it means. Different presidential speaking styles, and a total look at the 2008 election and why what happened happened. So, hope that's useful to you. MyHistoryCanBeatUpYourPolitics.com. Thanks for listening.